And thank you for standing by. At this time, all parties are on a listen-only mode. I would like to inform all parties this call is being recorded. If you should have any objections, please disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to Mr. Kenneth Frank. You may begin.
Thank you, Shelby. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the third of our Night Sky Network's 2011 bi-monthly series of teleconferences. Shelby, if you'd please now open up the lines, we'll find out who's listening and who's out there and what club they're affiliated with before introducing our speaker this evening. Hello, Shelby?
Yes, I am opening lines at this
Great.
Time.
Great. Thank you very much.
Yes. Please feel free to introduce yourself.
Hi, this is Michael Forrester, and we are broadcasting this on Astronomy.fm.
Thank you very much, Michael. That's great. Thank you.
Glad to be here. Tom Dorsey, Ferndale, WACO, Watcom Association.
How are you, Tom?
Watcom Association of Celestial Observers in Ferndale, Washington.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. This is Stuart Myers from AAI. Yeah, you may remember me. Some of you may remember me from NEAT.
All right. Thanks for showing up, Stuart.
I'm Art Zorka from Atlanta Astronomy Club.
Thank you. Welcome.
Bruce Tinkler, listening in Lexington, Massachusetts, from the Amateur Telescope Makers of Boston, and I actually made it tonight.
Oh, hi, Bruce. Well, I'm still going to ask the question for you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm Virginia Renahan from Amateur Telescope Makers of Boston, calling from Gloucester, Massachusetts.
Oh.
Hi, I'm Stein from Stillwater Waters in Troy, Ohio.
You're welcome.
I'm Linda Prince from the Amateur Society of New York.
Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Lee Green from Twin City Amateur Astronomers.
Ree Lott from Charlie Elliott Chapel Astronomy Club.
Hi.
Christian Bergman from the City Astronomy Club, humble servant of the Night Sky Network.
Thank you. Welcome aboard.
Joanne Trees, Kiske Astronomers, New Kensington, Pennsylvania.
Hey, hi.
Hello, my name is Jack Bell from the Treasure Coast Astronomical Society of Port St. Lucie, Florida.
Thanks, Jack. It must be nice and warm down there in Florida.
Too warm, yes.
Jerry Anderson, JUC, Golden, Colorado.
Great, thanks. All right, well, I think we've just
gotten there.
Great. Thank you. So, Shelby, I think if you'd close up the lines now, we've got at least a sampling of the folks out there tonight.
Okay, at this time, I am closing lines. All parties will be on a listen only.
And it sure is wonderful to hear from so many Night Sky Network members all around the country who have joined us this evening. We're pleased to have Dr. Jeffrey Van Cleef as our speaker.
Hear any of that?
Oops.
Yeah. It was a little jumbled up there. It'll be clearer now.
Okay. We're pleased to have Dr. Jeffrey Van Cleef as our speaker this evening for his presentation entitled Stargazers, Starfarers, and Kepler. We also have the pleasure of having Marnie Berenson, our ASP Education Project Coordinator and Mentor, and a lot more, will be listening in along with us this evening and monitor night sky info at astrosociety.org. Hi, Marnie.
Hi, everybody. Great to hear from you.
Dr. Jeffrey Van Cleef is an astronomer and a support scientist on the Kepler team, and he enjoys learning a little bit about a lot of things and explaining them to others. And he's worked on several projects, including the Spitzer Space Telescope, where he focused on infrared spectroscopy. In his area of special expertise on Kepler, as on his previous flight programs, is the focal planes. Dr. Van Cleve always wanted to know, always knew he always wanted to be an astronaut, and alas, his poor vision, although I don't see you wearing glasses now, was an obstacle towards this particular dream that couldn't be overcome. And give up on space? Never. And he soldiered on with myself.
I actually did some soldering in graduate school, so that's good improvisation.
I did
there.
That a lot as a kid on the Heath kit. On science gathering inspiration from Captain Kirk, Albert Einstein, and his supportive parents. That's wonderful. And without further ado to our telecon audience, please welcome Dr. Jeffrey Van Cleve.
Hey, thanks for inviting me to be here tonight. It's a pleasure to share Kepler's exciting scientific discoveries and some of my own philosophical and speculative thoughts that accompany them. The first page of my presentation shows the observatory at Chichen Itza in the Mayan Yucatan, and I will talk about that in the second half of my talk, and in the first half I'm going to talk about Kepler's scientific discoveries. Next slide, which should be slide two. So I'm going to describe Kepler's scientific mission in some detail and its early results, and then in the second half of the presentation offer some of my own thoughts about what Kepler means from the perspectives of the past, the present, and the future. And this slide shows some of the themes that I'll touch on in the second half of the presentation, going back to pyramids and Chichen Itza in the past, and what Kepler's discoveries tell us about the possible prevalence of habitable worlds and extraterrestrial intelligence. Next slide. It's really interesting to work on a project that offers modern answers to ancient questions. And you see from the quotations on this page here next to the portrait of Kepler that people have been discussing this for over 2,000 years. Up until our own time, it has been philosophical speculation, which has never reached a conclusion because you can't deduce from pure logic whether planets like ours exist. People have tried, but it never reaches a conclusion. So what's special about our own time is that we live in a time where that debate and speculation can be replaced by knowledge obtained from observation. Now, that doesn't mean that there's an end of debate and speculation. I go to any scientific conference and you'll find a lot of that. But it's a great step forward from not having any data at all and trying to reason this out from first principles. And NASA's Kepler mission is a prime example of that, even though other missions and ground-based observations have contributed. The quantity and quality of Kepler data allows us to answer some of these ancient questions, and of course, as science always does, raise new questions, which annoys people who fund us because it's like, well, we paid you to answer some questions and you keep coming up with new ones. What's going on here? But that's part of the journey of discovery, and that's what makes it a vital enterprise instead of something that ends at one particular time. The next slide, slide four, talks about what I consider the three big questions. How did we get here? Where are we going? Are we alone in the universe? And big questions like that can be given mathematical form by something called the Drake equation, which many of you have probably heard of. And the brilliant thing about the Drake equation, which I admire Frank Drake for, is that it really didn't provide answers to questions, but it packaged our ignorance in a very appealing way. And I think that's a brilliant thing. The paper's like 4 pages long, and it's been cited 5,000 times, literally. So he took this question, this big question of are we alone in the universe, and asked, well, what is that question made up of? What other questions multiplied together, so to speak, give us an answer to that? And that's what the Drake equation is. So the number of civilizations that might be communicating with us which is big N on this equation here, is a product of the rate of formation of suitable stars and the fraction of stars with planetary systems, the number of Earth-like worlds per planetary system, fraction of those Earth-like planets where life actually develops, the fraction of places with life where you get intelligence, and the fraction of intelligent species that actually wind up doing something like what we've done in the last 60 years, which means build radio telescopes and space probes. And then a final term of how long a communicating civilization lasts. So ultimately, we'd like to know what all of these things multiplied together are. But what's beautiful about the Drake equation, it allows us to pick off one of these terms at a time and work on what we can work on with the time and resources available. And so the terms that are highlighted in red are what Kepler's working on now, which is the fraction of stars that have planetary systems and the number of Earth-like worlds per planetary system. And, you know, for the future, there are the terms to the right of the red terms. But it's a wonderful thing to be able to actually make some progress. And that's the path, that's the roadmap that the Drake equation has laid out for us. Next slide, slide 5. An overview of the Kepler mission is that it was meant to detect transits of Earth-sized planets in the habitable zone of a main-sequence star. A transit is the dimming of a star's light when it passes in front of it. A poetic way of looking at this is saying that Kepler's goal is to look for the shadows of other Earths. And I show an illustration here on the left when a planet the size of Jupiter passes in front of the Sun. That little black dot there, it blots out about 1% of the star's light, which is challenging, but not impossible to detect a 1% change in starlight from the ground. Those of you who are amateur astronomers with CCDs probably do this, at least if you live in New Mexico or somewhere with nice skies. To detect an Earth or Venus-sized planet, though, that's 1% of 1%, or part in 10,000, or 100 parts per million. And that's well nigh impossible from the ground. So that was our justification for a space-based mission. And it's sometimes difficult to explain in words what a transit is and what we're looking for in extrasolar planets. But there's an iPhone app that is called Exoplanet that you can download from the education section of the iTunes store. I use it all the time to show people what a transit is. It has a list of extrasolar planets and how they were discovered, whether by transits or other means. And when you click on a planet that was discovered by transit, it makes a little animated light curve like the one shown in the middle of my slide here. So, you know, if you're at cocktail parties and want to show that you know what's going on with astronomy and extrasolar planets, it's really great. I take the phone out all the time, show people what a transit is, and that replaces a lot of hand-waving or looking for a napkin to write things on. So I highly recommend it. So that's what Kepler does. It looks at 100,000 stars at a time because transits don't happen that frequently. Of course, if you're looking at the Earth, it happens once a year. But the star system also has to be lined up just right so the planet passes between you and the star. And that's relatively unlikely. It happens only 1% of the time, even if there is a planet there, to cause a transit. So you have to look at a lot of stars at once in the hope that a few thousand of them will show transits of one kind or another. Let's go to the next slide, which is slide 6. So I just said something about habitable worlds. So what does that mean? Well, kind of working definition is that possible to have liquid water there. It's not too hot, not too cool. So that's between 0 and 100 Celsius, or 32 and 212 Fahrenheit for you Americans. And you need some kind of surface to live on or near, so it can't be a gas giant like Neptune. And it can't be too small, so small that it doesn't have air to breathe. So this picture here shows me assessing as to whether San Francisco is habitable, and I clearly see liquid water as possible. There's a surface to stand on, and the air was pretty nice that day. In the future, there's more details we could learn about planets from other missions, but Kepler won't actually tell us if the water's actually present. He'll just tell us whether the temperatures allows that to be. But that's still a huge increase over our previous knowledge. So I'm going on to the next slide, which is slide 7. So when a planet passes in front of a star, it does that, and then a year later, or whatever corresponds to a year for that planet, the event happens again. So what we measure with Kepler is what's the period of the orbit and how big is the planet. And you just heard me talk about temperatures, so it's like, how do you get temperatures from period? Well, that's partly why the mission is named for Kepler, because there's a mathematical relationship called Kepler's third law, which relates the orbital radius of the planet, that is how far it is from the star, to its period. And what's really cool about that is on this log-log plot, it's a straight line, or and equivalently it's a power law shown in the upper left-hand corner. But what's really interesting is that you could make this same plot for other star systems, just shift it up or down by the inverse square root of the star's mass relative to that of the sun. So orbital periods for a star that's one quarter the mass of the sun would be twice of what's shown on this chart. We can get a good idea of the star's mass by how bright it is and what its diameter is because of a relationship called the main sequence in astronomy. So we apply this chart here to the period that we measure. We know, have some idea about the mass, so we can get the idea of how far the planet is from the star. And we also know how intrinsically bright the star is. So if we know how bright the star is burning, how far the planet is, we can calculate its surface temperature. So it's a little bit roundabout, but most of this is on solid enough foundation that we feel we can make a pretty solid relationship between the period of the planet and its surface temperature, given decent knowledge of the parent star of the planet. So this is partly why it's called Kepler, because we use Kepler's third law to turn periods into surface temperatures. Moving on to slide 8, it shows a picture in the clean room at Ball Aerospace, my previous employer, where Kepler was being built. Ball was the prime contractor for Kepler. And the particular part, as Ken mentioned before, that I worked on is the focal planes, which are CCDs in this case. And CCDs are basically imaging chips like what you have in your digital camera, except the camera we built has 100 million pixels instead of, say, 8 megapixels, which is what a kind of decent commercial digital camera has. And on that right-hand picture there, the guy in the clean suit is my lab partner, Joe Manriquez. You get to recognize people just by their eyebrows when you work in the clean room. It's kind of funny, but I can tell just by looking at his eyes and his eyebrows that's Joe, my lab buddy, making sure that all is well and clean with the CCD there. So you see how big Kepler is because there's a person in that middle, that picture there in the middle. It's about a 1 meter or 3 foot aperture, and it covers 100 square degrees of sky, which is kind of interesting to think about, because when you look at Hubble pictures, like you might have heard of the Hubble Deep Field, well, that patch of sky is about the size of a grain of sand held at arm's length, while the patch of sky that Kepler stares at repeatedly for 4 years is about the size of your whole hand held out at arm's length. So it's a much bigger piece of sky. Another way to think of it is that it's 20 times the diameter of the full moon. So that takes a little bit of getting used to. My previous project was the Spitzer Space Telescope, and that's one of these grain of sand things instead of whole hand things in terms of the amount of sky. But it has to cover that much sky so that there's over 100,000 decent stars to look at that have the right brightness and that are dwarf stars like our sun instead of bloated giants that not only might have consumed their own planets, but are so big that you can't see the little shadow of an Earth-sized planet compared to the star size, because the star is so big. So moving on to the next slide, we have to decide where we want to look. And it's an important question because we want to stare at the same patch of sky for the whole mission. Because if we want to see a planet like Earth in an orbit like Earth repeat its transit several times, in order to be sure that what we're seeing is a transit, not something else, then we have to look at a star for 2 or 3 or 4 years. And so we decide we're going to stare at the same patch of sky. We want to look close to the galactic plane, so there's lots of stars, but not right in the galactic plane because there's dust and a very higher proportion of giant stars, which are undesirable and not really the stars we're interested in. If what we're looking for is Earth-like planets around Sun-like stars. And we also want the place we look to be a place where the Sun never gets close to during its travel around the zodiac throughout the year. So we picked a location in the constellation Cygnus, the Swan, which is near Deneb and Altair and Vega, as you see in the picture here, which some of you may know as the Summer Triangle, which is visible overhead around midnight in July. So that's where we've decided to look with Kepler. The next slide shows how we look at the stars. We don't take pictures of the whole sky because we have 100 million pixels and we're collecting data every half hour, basically, on those pixels. And Kepler's in its own orbit around the Sun, a couple of million miles away, so that it would be a nice, steady, stable orbit, so there wouldn't be any disturbances to confuse our search for very small changes in brightness. And so we don't have the downlink budget to send down all the pixels. And when you think about it, we're not really interested at taking pictures of all the dark space between the stars. We just want to learn about our stars. And so what we do is define what we call target apertures, which are shown in green in the picture on slide 10. And those are the slides we actually bring down. And the pixels we actually bring down, the pixels that are in red are stars we're not interested because they're either giants or too dim. And the pixels that are green, but kind of greenish-white, those are the pixels that contain the most information about the star that lies within that green aperture. And this by and large, works pretty well. But once a month, we take a full picture of the sky, including all the pixels, just to make sure there isn't anything funny going on with the instrument and to help us calibrate it. On the next slide, slide 11, that shows a pretty picture of Kepler's night launch on March 6th, Florida time, around 10:30, and it's nothing quite like a night launch. You spend years working on a mission and hope that the fire comes out of the right end of the rocket. The longest 8 minutes of my life, except the 8 minutes I spent watching the Spitzer Space Telescope take off in 2003, but again, things worked out well, and Kepler went into its trailing heliocentric orbit and started doing its thing in a couple of days after this. Slide 12 shows our first light picture. When we first turned on Kepler, we took a full picture, not just the target apertures. And it shows a couple of interesting things. On the upper left, there's a previously known giant planet from ground-based observations. Remember I mentioned that you could see planets the size of Jupiter from the ground if you're careful and you have nice clear skies and photometric conditions. And so we wanted to have a few planets in there that we knew about already so we could check our results. And in the upper right-hand corner is a star cluster, NGC 6791, which is scientifically interesting because we can study a bunch of stars that were born together, and so that eliminates one variable in understanding the life history of stars and the probability that they'll have planets like the Earth. Next slide is slide 13, and it shows the first published scientific result of Kepler based on the first 10 days of data. And in the upper left-hand corner, we show previous ground-based data from a collaboration called HAT. I think it's the Hungarian Astronomical Telescope. They do a really nice job with limited resources, but they're limited by the Earth's atmosphere. And so if you compare the panel on the left to the upper panel on the right, you can see that the Kepler data, which is on the right, is a lot less noisy. And in fact, we have to blow up the Kepler data by a factor of 100 to get about the same amount of scatter as you see in the ground-based data. And so what was discovered here is not the planet that was known before, but we saw a secondary eclipse, which is when the planet passes behind the star. And that's interesting because it means the planet itself is giving us some light at visible light wavelengths, and that means it's like red hot. And that's consistent with its short period orbit, which means it's really close to its star. So this is, you know, it's not an Earth-like planet, but it demonstrates that under good conditions, Kepler can achieve that 100 part per million precision. If you look at the scale on the bottom panel on the right side, it says relative flux, where 1 corresponds to the average flux. You see that the scale is 1.0001, and then below the 1 is 0.9999. So one step on that scale is 100 parts per million. So that's a really nice illustration that we can do what we said we could do most of the time. So on slide 14, I show our planets, some of our planets published to date, and their temperatures and sizes. The temperature of the parent star, from which we derive the temperature of the planet, is derived from ground-based and Kepler observations. And as I mentioned before, the distance of the planet from the star is determined by Kepler's third law. One thing we can't calculate is the effect of an atmosphere on a planet's temperature. When we do our calculation of a planet's temperature, we neglect the greenhouse effect, which can be substantial. I mean, for example, Venus is closer to the sun than the Earth, but it has highly reflective cloud layers, and so the amount of sunlight actually absorbed by the planet per square meter is about the same as that for the Earth. However, because of the massive carbon dioxide atmosphere that Venus has, its surface temperature is hot enough to melt lead. Unfortunately, Kepler can't tell us if that's going on. We certainly know that if a planet's temperature is over 100 degrees Celsius in the absence of an atmosphere is only going to make things worse, but that's something future missions will have to determine. So when you see planet temperature here, the caveat is as we calculate what that temperature would be if we could neglect the greenhouse effect, which, as we know, even here on planet Earth, we cannot neglect the greenhouse effect. So moving on to the next slide, which is, let me point out a couple of things here, at least the largest and smallest. Our smallest and hottest planets are Kepler-10b and Kepler-9b, respectively, and as you see from the temperature scale, they're over 2,500 Fahrenheit, and in the same category as the first planet I showed you in the sense of being hot enough to give off their own light. They are, however, much smaller. All these globes here are drawn to scale, and so you can see we're getting down to Earth-sized planets, even though they're hot. And that's no surprise, because the hot planets go around more quickly, and so the results come a little more quickly. Next slide, slide 15. Shows the number of planet candidates that we've discovered to date. And when Kepler, on a Kepler light curve strongly suggests a planet, that finding is called a planet candidate. Now, candidates are only upgraded to planet discoveries or confirmed planets when alternative explanations have been ruled out by ground-based observations and a detailed modeling of the light curve. and you've seen the transit happen at least three times with equal intervals between the events, and that proves it's something periodic. And that kind of slows us down from publishing, but this field has such a long and sorry history of retracted planet discoveries that we don't want to be part of that history, and so we carefully confirm things. So we've published 15 confirmed planets, but we have over 1,200 planet candidates, as shown by this histogram here. And the majority of the ones we've seen so far in the Kepler data are about Neptune-sized. And there are fewer Jupiter-sized ones, which is interesting because it's, of course, easier to see the big planets rather than the smaller or middle-sized planets. And so the fact that there's fewer of them means that there really are fewer of them. It's not like we're missing them. At the other end, however, the fact that we've detected only 68 Earth-sized planets compared to 662 Neptune-sized planets just means that it's harder to see the smaller planets, and we won't know until we gather more data. One thing that's particularly interesting about this chart here is that there's objects called super-Earth-sized, and there's several hundred of them, and there are none of these objects in our solar system. Super-Earths are bigger than roughly twice the diameter of the Earth, but smaller than Neptune. And so these are an unknown kind of planets. We don't know. Are they going to be, like, have gaseous surfaces or water surfaces, or will they be rock and metal? We don't know. That's what's really interesting. A whole new class of planets has shown up here that's considerably bigger than the Earth and considerably smaller than Neptune. Neptune, as you may recall, is four Earth diameters across, and so that range between like 1.5 and 3 times the Earth's diameter is new planetary science, and we're very much looking forward to understanding these. And so of these planet candidates shown here, about 50 are thought to be in the habitable zone. So that's another dimension of our exploration. So let's go to slide 16 now. And this shows the Kepler, before Kepler, what transiting planets were known. They tended to be big and hot, that is to say, in short period orbits, and that makes them easier to discover. Most were discovered by ground-based searches using a method called radial velocity, which uses the gravitational tug of the planet on the star to study whether there's a planet there. And a few of these were discovered by COROW, the European mission. The next slide shows the Kepler candidates as of February 1st, 2011, and you can see that they are much more numerous and comprise objects that are not only much smaller than Earth or even Jupiter, but are starting to get down into candidate equilibrium temperatures, which not quite have reached the temperature of boiling water, but are getting there. Next slide, slide 18, is a blow-off of the region of most interest, which is small planets at low temperatures. And you can see that we've discovered planets in the habitable zone that are super-Earths, roughly 1.4 times the diameter of the Earth. And there's like that one dot down there just below the one line. I wouldn't write a paper about that till that's confirmed. That's just a single point. But you see the pattern that's emerging is that as the longer we look, the smaller the planets we can see and the cooler the planets we can see. And so we're confident that in the fullness of time, we will be able to push that collection of points down to smaller planet sizes and lower equilibrium temperatures, which is what we really would look forward to. So that concludes the scientific results of Kepler to date. There's a lot more to come, and the payoff from this mission grows a lot faster than linear with time. If you're looking for one-year period planets, and you look for 9 months, you don't get anything. You look for a year and a half, you see one transit. Who knows what that means? You look for 2.5 years, you see two transits. That means almost nothing. But then if you stick it out and wait the 3 or 4 years and you see three transits and you see that the time between those transits is exactly equal, you've all of a sudden got a big payoff after lots of waiting. So it takes a great deal of patience because it's like a big wave coming in. And we're working hard at this, but I expect the number of papers to really explode in the next couple of years. And we're grateful to have the time to actually do this job right. So what I want to do in conclusion here in the last few slides is offer some personal thoughts about where Kepler fits into the past, the present, and the future, and why this is interesting and how it's connected to other things. Next slide is slide 20, which is a picture I took when I was down in the Yucatan of the Castillo, which is one of the great buildings down there, along with the observatory that I showed on my opening slide. And when I see things like this, it kind of reminds me of my own situation in that many people carry the stones and a few people get to stand on top and look at the stars. And so without really being tongue-in-cheek, I'm grateful that our political and tax system supports this kind of stuff. And I'm very honored to be one of the few that get to stand on top and look at the stars through Kepler. And it's very satisfying then to convey what we're learning to everybody else. So that's why I like to do things like this. The Mayans did not have telescopes or computers. What they did have was their society's belief that what they were doing was of the greatest importance, and the patience to look at the sky every night for centuries to record what they saw and look for patterns. And so that patience I find highly admirable in our modern day of tweets and 30-second attention spans and so forth. I really do look up to that. Next slide is slide 21, which is a picture of Tycho Brahe from a trip I took to the island of Fen, which is in the strait between Sweden and Denmark. Tycho was Kepler's boss. He had an observatory that was state-of-the-art at the time and made his observations of Mars available to Kepler. And Kepler was able to explain the orbit of Mars by his three laws of planetary motion, that there was no way to explain what Tycho saw except to posit that the planets move on elliptical orbits and that when they're further out from the sun on that ellipse, they move more slowly than when they're close in. And Tycho's observations made that conclusion possible because they were actually precise enough to rule out other explanations of what was going on. On a personal note, Tycho's a role model for many astronomers I know in that his life was full of feasting, drinking, storytelling, and taking unmatched astronomical data produced with his state-of-the-art instrumentation. However, this picture is a warning in that it shows the consequences of 30 years of boozing with the older Tycho on the left and the young Tycho on the right. So you can see that the Lord of Fen accumulated a great deal of mileage from his socializing outside the observatory. On the next slide, slide 22, shows Tycho's tools. In the upper left-hand corner was a sextant he used to measure the distance between planets and stars at various points in their journey across the sky. And at the bottom left is a kind of like a gigantic astrolabe where he measured the altitude of planets and stars above the horizon. And the green arrow points to a blow-up view of the beautifully machined brass and steel calipers. And you can see, if you look closely at the picture in the lower right, markings on it like a giant protractor. And so you would sight down those parallel steel rods at the pin at the end, and you could locate objects to one-tenth of an arc second, which is one arc second, which is considerably smaller than a grain of sand held at arm's length. and that's the precision that allowed Kepler to do his job. In the upper right is a picture of Tycho's underground observatory. Now, it sounds kind of odd to say that you have an astronomical observatory underground, right, because the stars are above the ground. Well, Tycho was actually a pretty good instrumentalist, and he realized that if you wanted to do really precise measurements, you had to control the temperatures of your instruments so that they wouldn't warp and screw up your measurements. And you know, what's really funny about that is the principle, one of the principal causes of instrumental artifacts in Kepler data is temperature changes. And so that's, I always enjoy seeing how the past is like the present. So he put these instruments that you see in the other three panels in an underground observatory covered by a green copper dome, and opened windows in the dome to sight along the stars. And so being underground kept the temperature steady and allowed him to do precise and repeatable measurements. The next slide is a picture from the Campo di Fiori showing Giordano Bruno. And I made a pilgrimage there during my visit to Rome a few months ago, and just kind of sat and thought and left some Kepler pins at the feet of the statue. One of the things I thought of was sometimes being on the cutting edge of astronomical speculation has its costs. Giordano Bruno was burned at the stake in 1600 in Rome for, among other things, professing his metaphysical belief in the plurality of habitable worlds, which is exactly what the Kepler mission is investigating today. But the difference is that we're investigating these questions by observation and data analysis rather than by philosophical discussion and deduction. In fairness of the Church, it's important to note that Dr. Bruno was guilty of profound theological errors as well as his belief in habitable worlds, and that the Vatican now has Jesuit astronomers and its own observatory in Arizona. So sometimes 400 years makes a big difference in people's attitudes. The next slide, slide 26, takes us from... slide 24. I jumped ahead there. I was leaping right from the past to the future without stopping momentarily in the present. In the present, Kepler's search for planets is related to SETI's search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And a really interesting idea is if you think that aliens are motivated like we are and have similar technological abilities, and you ask yourself the question, suppose aliens built something like Kepler and they found us, well, where would those aliens be? So, if at some time of the year our Earth passes between the Sun and the alien homeworld, then 6 months later our Sun passes between us and them. And so therefore, the alien homeworld must lie in the part of the sky traversed by the Sun as it goes around the sky during the year. That's called the ecliptic, or in a broader sense, the zodiac. And so the aliens who are most likely to know about us might be in the ecliptic, and so we can focus our search for radio signals on just 0.5% of the whole sky, which is a band of the ecliptic that has a diameter the same as the Sun. And so that's how SETI today is related to Kepler's discoveries and visualizing how other beings might use something like Kepler to find us. So the next slide shows a little more about why we should listen for ET among the constellations of the zodiac. And we should point our radio telescopes in that direction, which is nothing new for me. Seth Shostak and Steve Kilston, formerly of Ball Aerospace, a few other people have thought about that. But that suggests that maybe instead of looking for a needle in a haystack, we can look for a needle in a bucketful of straw instead. And so that was something we were looking forward to doing real soon now, not because we've discovered planets in the ecliptic. In fact, we chose our Kepler field of view to look away from the ecliptic. But that aliens that discovered us might be transmitting to us in the ecliptic, and then planets that we did find with Kepler might have radio civilizations on them. Sadly, federal and state funding cutbacks for the operations of UC Berkeley's Hat Creek Radio Observatory have forced the hibernation of the Allen Telescope Array, which is what's pictured in the upper right-hand corner here. Public help is needed to keep it going. It's particularly sad that the ATA was going to look for signals from planets found by Kepler, and at some future point do the other half of this thought, which is to look for radio signals from the ecliptic, not from planets Kepler found, but from beings that found us using something like Kepler. So hopefully that'll get straightened out. If you want to learn more about the funding problem, it's on the front page of SETI.org, and they'll tell you all about it. So we're hoping that gets going, because the sky's a really big place, and if you have some specific actionable information about where to look for something like ET, it's a shame not to be able to use it. The next slide is going from the present to the future. And I like this picture by John Lomberg. It shows you just how much of the galaxy Kepler is looking at. And the point is a very small portion. It's like a little weak flashlight we're shining out into the sea of suns there. And so there's vast numbers of stars that Kepler's not looking at for planets. And Kepler's not going to find all the planets or even all the planets that are nearby. But what it will tell us that's really important is the statistics of it. What fraction of planets like our sun, what planets or stars like our sun have planets like the Earth? And so even though it's a small flashlight, we're still going to learn a lot more about our neighborhood. And that'll help us build the missions of the future that might locate the nearest stars and possibly inform our search for ET, as I mentioned before. The next slide is slide 27. It's an illustration of the nearby stars. As I said before, we don't know from Kepler which of these nearby stars have Earth-like planets, but we can figure out better how to look for them from the results of Kepler. And then on my final slides, some thoughts about interstellar civilizations and whether they exist or not and how that's related to what we're doing with Kepler. So, again, we're not going to find the nearest Earth-like planets, but if we find that every star like our sun has a habitable planet, then the mean distance between habitable planets is about 10 light years, in which case we have to wonder about the other terms in the Drake equation to explain why we haven't heard from anyone yet. Is intelligence really unlikely, or is technology really unlikely? Of course, you can have intelligence without technology. I mean, we have dolphins on this planet. We don't know. Is technology inherently self-destructive? We just don't know. Like so much of astronomy, we're trying to draw grand conclusions from a single data point. So, but Kepler will at least start to fence in some of the possible explanations for what some of you may have heard called the Fermi paradox or the long silence. Kepler finds no Earths or a very small number of Earths, then the mean distance between habitable planets is 100 light years or more, in which case civilizations are fewer, and the possibility of propagating from planet to planet may be so forbidding that intelligence is not ubiquitous but confined to a few homeworlds of origin. And then if there's only a handful of star systems that ever do develop intelligent life. You know, the galaxy isn't only really big, it's really old too. So even if like civilization lasts a million years, okay, which is you know, pretty good going the way things are going now down here. Civilizations last a million years, but it's just not practical, no matter what your technological level, to colonize other star systems. Then even if it's fairly frequent, in the last 4 billion years, if there's been 100 civilizations, we'd have less than a 2% chance of existing at the same time as one of those million-year-old civilizations. And so we could still have a good probability of looking forward to a million years of what we call civilization here on the Earth as a typical intelligent species. But if it's not possible to colonize other star systems and propagate to all habitable worlds, then we might not hear anything. But that allows us to interpret the long silence in a somewhat more optimistic way. So we'll see. Either way, the results are profoundly interesting, and it's been my pleasure to share my interest with you on this this telecon. So with that, I conclude my presentation and look forward to your questions.
Well, thanks very much, Dr. Van Cleef. Very something to ponder about, for sure. we're going to open up the lines for questions one at a time, and while we're waiting for questions, Bruce Tinkler, who ended up showing up after all or listening in, I'm just going to, for expediency, I'm going to read his question to you, Dr. Van Cleef. He's from the Amateur Telescope Makers of Boston, and if he wants to add more, he certainly can. And Bruce asks, Earth-Moon is a noticeable percentage of the Earth's size. And I'm going to interject here before I forget. If you can't make it to the telecon, and I'm going to add this to future speakers' notes, email us your questions when you look at the PowerPoint or you have some questions about what, you know, in overall. It's a great way to do this. And with Kepler's current technology of the solar system, we're being imaged at the distance we're currently examining with Kepler. Do we have the sensitivity to detect a moon similar to the Earth's orbiting planet, assuming enough observations to catch the differences in the light curve? And will Kepler be doing this in the future, if not now? And Bruce also states it was great meeting the NSM team at NEAF.
Hmm.
That was fun. Vivian and Marnie were there. Wish I could have been there. Anyway, what do you say, Jeff?
Well, from my chart that I was showing earlier, we're finding planets, I think, with a decent degree of completeness that are 1.4 times the diameter of the Earth. And the Moon is one quarter the diameter of the Earth, so that's a much smaller signal because it's not the proportion to the diameter, but the diameter squared, that's your signal. And so an object that's one of these super-Earths that we're now fairly easily detecting has a signal 36 times bigger than the Earth's moon. And so that, all other things being equal, makes it a far more difficult chore to do that. That being said, not all things are necessarily equal. If the star that the planet and the moon are around is much smaller than the sun, for example, some M dwarfs are only one quarter of the sun's radius, that could largely offset the difference in planet size. And so it's possible with Kepler that a moon the size of our moon in a orbit around a planet Earth-sized or larger could be detectable if the parent star is a cool M dwarf. On the other hand, there aren't many cool M dwarfs that are also bright enough to give us a good signal. And so while it's possible, it's not likely that the orbits would line up just right so that it would occur for at least one of the small number of relatively bright red dwarfs in our sample. So hope that wasn't too long an answer, but it would be really interesting, and it's not impossible, so we'll keep looking for it.
Great, great, excellent. Well, Shelby, if you'd have someone ask a question of Dr. Van Cleef, that'd be great.
Certainly. As a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. We do have our first question from Stuart Myers. Your line is open.
Hello. Let's see, a very interesting presentation tonight.
Thank you.
And I don't know if you're aware of this, but I was reading on one of the Space News websites that they're going to be using the Robert Byrd Telescope in West Virginia to check out a couple of the extrasolar planets Kepler detected.
Yeah, I remember in some of the email traffic that followed the closure of the Allen telescope that Jeff Marcy, a member of our science team, had gotten time on the bird there and was listening in. So I'm glad to hear that that it is going forward. That being said, the bird is used for many other scientific projects, and so we won't get nearly the amount of time.
I know. The thing I read on the news website, they claim they're only going to be pointing the scope at each one of the candidates for only an hour.
Yeah, I guess that's the equivalent. You can look at a few stars for a while.
How they could have a real chance of success if they only look at it for such a short time.
Yeah, I suppose, again, a lot of this, when I talked about, SETI, there's a certain assumptions about alien motivations.
Right,
if their motivation is to provide an easily detectable beacon, okay, then looking for an hour ought to be able to do that if they're a technological civilization. Okay. If it's just like leakage or accidental, we don't know. We don't know what frequency to listen
to. I think the best strategy would be to search on frequencies that would be used by, say, their weather radar or their defense radars, because those are the most powerful transmitters in our society.
That are inadvertent leakages of electromagnetic radiation as opposed to an intentional beacon.
Yeah. You hear on the TV stations and stuff how they talk about they have the 2 million watt Doppler radar.
Yeah. Yep. I know. I think it's the best strategy to follow given the resources available. But Alan was built for methodically investigating this question.
Also, such a strategy would not depend on motivation.
Right.
Because any advanced civilization living on a planet with an atmosphere would have to keep track of the weather. And if there were any aliens living on a planet which was still divided up into nation states, there's a good possibility they'd still have defense radars.
Yeah, and in terms of motivation, suppose you're in a dark, silent jungle in the middle of the night. Are you the one that wants to make noise first to see what happens? That's a whole nother talk.
Well, thank you very much, Stuart.
Cool.
And always nice to hear your comments and positive remarks about the speakers.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Bruce Tinkler. Your line is open.
Okay, I just have a quick follow-up because of random happenstance here.
Mm-hmm.
Tonight at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, there was a public lecture on Kepler planets given by Dr. David Latham.
Mm.
So it was interesting to be able to hear his discussion, ask the same question, and get his response as well. And he, in his reaction to my question, actually gave away a little bit more than I think he wanted to, and that is that he does have a graduate student that is actually looking for satellites around planets. And in addition to looking for them via light curves, you can also look for the perturbation of the transit timing as another way of trying to track these satellites down. And just the emotion that he conveyed gave a lot of us the impression at that particular presentation that there may be some news about this that will be announced at some point in the future.
Yeah, it's certainly an idea that's been around for years. There was a postdoc here named Jason Barnes who worked on the specific problem of looking for satellites of planets around other stars. But what was interesting in particular to me about your question was that it was specific about a moon-sized planet. So, but you're right, transit timing variations are another way of doing that as opposed to direct photometric detection. And I remember seeing a really nice article in Sky and Telescope like 6 months ago about transit timing variations and what you could learn about a planet or planet and its moon from that. That was really nice. I wish I could remember what month that was in.
Yeah, and he was also mentioning about the planet interactions between themselves in a multiple system and how the transit timings could also be used to learn more about the planets in that way as well.
Yeah, one of our most interesting recent discoveries, I think it was Kepler 11 or something, they found like six planets around the same star that were all in the same plane. It was like as that Whoa. Star system, including its planets, was like flat, like a CD. Yeah. Mm. And so this planetary system is like a real playpen for the physics of gravitational interactions and transit timing variations, and they're just starting to mine that for interesting information. In particular, from the transit timing variations, you can figure out the mass of the planet. If you know the mass and the size of the planet, you can start thinking deep thoughts about what the planet's made out of. So this is all like really exciting, and this was like published in February.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And as a side note, the Kepler Science Working Group is meeting at CFA tomorrow morning at 8 a.m., and Dave Latham is hosting it. And it's, of course, not open to the public, but it's kind of an interesting coincidence that, with the exception of me and one other two people back here at Ames, the Kepler team is in town for the AAS meeting, which is going on this week.
Thanks for that follow-up, Bruce.
And our next question comes from Jim Small. Your line is open.
Yeah, I was curious as to how detailed the light curves were and whether or not you could actually possibly detect an atmosphere by, you know, a tiny dip before the big dip from the planet cross.
That's an interesting question because it's actually doable if you have enough signal and noise. Is in the case of Venus, when Venus transits our own sun, careful observations of the moment of contact between Venus and the sun's disk can tell you something about Venus's atmosphere. But the sun is like a million times closer than these planets.
Right.
So I don't expect that for Earth-sized planets we would have the signal and noise that we need. For Jupiter-sized planets, especially ones that are so hot that there's a significant thermal emission from their surface, we can learn a little bit about the thermal properties of the planet and whether it has weather, actually. On the Spitzer Space Telescope, I did a project with Carl Grillmeyer of Caltech where we took spectra of a hot superplanet when it was in transit and when it was off to the side and when it was behind the star, and we differenced those spectra to get a spectrum of the planet itself with the starlight removed, and we found evidence for water and methane in that spectrum. So, if the planet's big enough, you can get that information. But I think it would be I would say, off the top of my head, like impossible to learn about the planet the size of the Earth's atmosphere. That still means there's possibility for learning some really interesting stuff.
Yeah, I thought it'd be kind of hard to get the details about the atmosphere, but I thought maybe it might be possible just to determine whether or not an atmosphere actually just existed.
I think if the planet is hot enough to re-radiate heat in the visible, you could learn about the atmosphere, but that's certainly not a habitable planet. So offhand, I'm skeptical that you could use Kepler for this. For super-Earths, maybe the James Webb Space Telescope would be capable of doing these kind of different spectra of individual objects. But I don't know enough about whether that's possible quantitatively off the top of my head.
And I guess the only other similar thing might be something like Saturn, where you had giant rings around the planet.
Yeah, there was a paper maybe by this Jason Barnes person also about like ring detection. And then just off to one side, I'll take this opportunity, there was a paper by a guy named Arnold that was published in, his last name was Arnold, it was in APJ Letters in 2006, and the title of the paper I think was Transit Signatures of Large Artificial Structures. And so what that was about is if an alien civilization was building objects that were shaped like rectangles or triangles that were like 10,000 miles across, you could tell that from the transit light curve. I'm not saying that we're actually looking for things like that here on the Kepler project, but I thought it was amazing you got it published in APJ Letters.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
No further questions at this time.
Oh. Wow. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Van Cleef, for your very stimulating, illuminating talk this evening. It was great. If you happen to be in Baltimore, I got to do the plug here, between July 30th and August 30th, or July 30th and August 4th, I think, the ASP in partnership with the American Geophysical Union and the Space Telescope Science Institute are going to hold a national conference on science education and public outreach entitled Connecting People to Science. And it's going to be held at the Tremont Plaza Hotel. It's a cool old hotel. I love it. In Baltimore. And for more information, check the ASP website.
Okay.
And again, Jeffrey, we want to thank you so much for taking the time and effort to engage us with this most interesting presentation.
All right. You're welcome. It was a pleasure to do stuff like this.
Great. I love it. And our next telecon is Thursday, July 28th, on the topic of astrobiology with Dr. David Morrison. So we want you to stay tuned. Thanks, everyone, and good night.
Okay,
thank you for
night.
Your participation.
You.
This concludes today's call. You may disconnect at this time.